The following lecture by Dr. Gordon H. Clark is entitled Language, Truth, and Revelation, Part 1.
This morning I want to turn to language. Language and theology. The first half of this book has to do with the logical positivists and their view of language. There won't be any time to go over that. That's too bad. Language philosophy began with vigor with Bertrand Russell. Not that there hadn't been any at all before. Plato's dialogue Cratylus investigated language. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau tried to and found it impossible. There were some writers in the 19th century, and I'll mention one in particular, who operated in New England with devastating effect on conservative Christianity. But mainly the language theorists are in the 20th century, and most of the time will be spent on them. The first one will be Wilbur Marshall Urban on page 85 of this book. And I hope you can understand what is written. I think it's rather easy. And as I read, you will notice somewhere on page 2 of the chapter, that would be somewhere page 86 or 7, I recommend that you read his volume on language and reality. It is a very interesting book. It's only 750 pages, so you ought to be able to do that by dinner time this evening. You will enjoy it no end. I'm not so sure you will enjoy my account of it, but don't let my account of it prevent you from reading it. And he has wonderful theories of poetry and things like this. And this very interesting author judiciously begins with the basic empiricism of John Locke. And you'll find out as I go on a little bit. He is one of the first men who made a major attack against the logical positivists. That's a point I want to make. We'll see about it. Come in. This very interesting author judiciously begins with the basic empiricism of John Locke. Locke had been surprised to find that he could not complete his essay concerning human understanding without investigating the relationship between thought and words. Berkeley learned from Locke and concluded that all, or most, I think he means about all confusions in philosophy, resulted from the use of words apart from the ideas that they symbolize, or should symbolize. Quote, "Draw the curtain of words to behold the fairest tree of knowledge." Bishop Berkeley could use the English language very well. That's a very nice phrase, but if you read the whole paragraph, the aesthetic response should be greater. Urban states the problem very clearly. This is it. If all words originate in sense experience, then when they are carried over into the non-physical, the problem of their valid reference to nonsensible ideas is immediately raised. Or further, quote, "The naturalistic and ultimately behavioristic view of language, which has developed of necessity from Darwinian premises, has brought with it a skepticism of the word, a distrust of language more fundamental than any hitherto experienced. The naturalization of language Now, by naturalization, he means understanding it in the philosophy of naturalism. The naturalization of language makes of it, in the last analysis, merely a method of adaptation to and control of environment, and denies to it, ab initio, all fitness for apprehending and expressing anything but the physical. End of quote. Or more pointedly, can advanced mathematics be expressed in words? Or is there a gap between the word and the world? If medieval nominalism denied universals, the new nominalism denies individuals, which is not a verbatim quotation, but that's approximately what he says. Then Urban asks the questions he intends to answer, and these four questions are repeated on the last page of the book with answers that are tied into the argument. Urban asks the questions he intends to answer first. How is language a bearer of meaning? Incidentally, it was this question that wrecked Stoicism in antiquity. They were materialists. They were not atomists, but they were materialists. And yet they had to acknowledge that words symbolize thoughts. And they were forced to modify and implicitly reject their original materialism in order to accommodate a view of language. I don't suppose any of you will look it up, but Breye, Émile Breye, wrote a very interesting monograph on Matteoli. Matteoli des incorporels chez Stoicism, or something like that. And that's the theory of incorporals. They had to have something incorporeal, even though they began as corporealists. A very interesting development a long time ago. The question they were faced with, how is language a bearer of meaning? How is communication possible? Third, what is the relation of logic to language? Fourth, how can language refer to things? They're the four questions that Urban takes on. This monograph, that is the book I'm reading from, this monograph has no intention of summarizing his 750-page answers. A few of his suggestive ideas are all that can be included here. Isn't it too bad that this isn't a two-semester course lasting from August to the following July, meeting five times a week for 3 hours a day? And we could cover a little bit in that time. Urban's material may be roughly divided into two parts. There are his refutations, not only of logical positivism, but of John Dewey also, and a few others. And second, there are his own constructive efforts. Some of the former is almost essential to an understanding of the latter. John Dewey held that language changed brute animals into thinking and knowing animals by creating the realm of meaning. Urban asks, was there not first a realm of meaning for the expression of which language was created? If language created meanings, then obviously things could have no meaning prior to language. Urban is willing to acknowledge that some meanings are created by language, but he's especially concerned to show that there must be pre-linguistic meaning. One example of this is the fact that a wolf will refuse to eat a piece of meat in which poison has been hidden. In some sense, the wolf senses a meaning. The bait means death. For the animal, however, the meaning is not detachable from the sensory thing, while for man, on the other hand, it is. Although human beings also sense these animal meanings, for example, when we begin to chew a bad nut and spit it out, these are for us extrinsic meanings also. John Dewey may say, as he does say, the clouds mean rain. But they do not mean rain in the same way that a bad taste causes us to spit it out. The clouds are a sign of a different physical event. If the clouds meant rain in the animal sense, they would mean the action of seeking shelter as the bad nut starts us spitting. But if the clouds really mean rain, there must be a certain individuation of both the sign and the thing indicated, which is not present in animal meaning. When the clouds mean rain, they do not necessarily mean seeking shelter. We may already be indoors looking at meteorological instruments. Meaning as a cue or stimulus to action, and meaning as a relation between a sign and the thing signified, are two different meanings of meaning. Or in other words, the behaviorist theory that a thing causes a reaction fails to distinguish mechanical habits from interpretation of signs. If the sign is merely causal, as an event in chemistry would do something else, if the sign is merely causal, there is no interpretation. Urban wants to insist on this point. Russell had said that meaning is an observable property of observable entities. Others of the same opinion say meaning is directly perceptible like color and sound. It is an object of direct perception. Urban acknowledges a sense in which this is true, Urban takes it as confusing. Russell's theory assumes things are given. But if only sensations are given, it is meaning that transforms sense data into things. Things are ideal constructions. Meaning is not something that is perceived. It is understood. When, however, Urban turns from criticizing Russell and the positivists and suggests something constructive, one must be cautious. He wants sounds to become words bearing meaning by their similarity to the things they designate. The word buzz is an imitation of the sound it signifies. Or the inherent meaning of the sound ache turns it into a word. Such onomatopoeic words are the first words of a language. Now, while the double Z in buzz may sound like the noise of sawing, what about the letter B? Why should it not have been fuzz or any other first letter of the alphabet? Then further, it is hard to see the similarity between the sound ache and a pain. Later, when he asserts that uatu, a word in some primitive language, sounds like and is a symbol of a stream, And that Uatuwu, for the same reason, means ocean. It is hard to follow him. There are, of course, onomatopoeic words, and there are also metaphors. Urban mentions the transference of the word kid, a young goat, to a human child. In fact, he says that metaphor is the primary law of speech construction. Does this not seem somewhat of an exaggeration? The introduction of the word its into the English language is hardly the result of a metaphor. Do you realize that the King James Version of the Bible doesn't have the word its in it anywhere from beginning to end? The word it hadn't been invented when the King James Bible was translated. It came into the English language later. But certainly it didn't come in as a metaphor of anything. Nor can the declining use of cases in Greek as a change to koine with the increasing use of prepositions, that can't be explained either. I think it is that New Testament lexicon by what's his name, Artin Gingrich, has a list of changes between classical Greek and Koine Greek, and the book is a big book. And there are several pages, both of words that do not occur in classical Greek or have changed their meaning, and also information as to how prepositions have taken the place of case endings in classical Greek. Koine Greek is noticeably different from classical Greek, and this is a development in language. But I don't think it is based on any extension of metaphors. Nor the virtual extinction of the optative mood. Now, I don't know how many times the optative occurs in the New Testament, but it's relatively rare. It occurs two or three times in maybe Ephesians and Colossians. And incidentally, the form of the optative in Koine is different from the form you learn when you do classical Greek. It's not the same form, but it is an optative. But the optative is very rare in the New Testament. And that can't be explained by the method that Urban is giving. However, in spite of those things that I consider flaws in Urban's linguistic theory, Urban's opposition to behaviorism is well based. And here comes a quotation that is directed against logical puzzling. In the words of C.S. Lewis, speech is only that part of behavior which is most significant of meanings and most useful for communication. He is describing logical positivism. The inability of the behavioristic theory to explain even animal meaning, if in the concept of meaning is included the notion of understanding or interpretation of signs, would inevitably bring with it the conclusion that a fortiori it is unable to explain linguistic meaning. The causal conception of meaning, let me indicate again what is meant by the causal conception of meaning. It's a chemical affair, you know. If you drop sodium into a pan of water, it explodes and catches fire and so on. Is that sodium or what? Is that right? I make mistakes, you know, sometimes. Well, that is ordinarily explained as a causality. Somehow or other, the water sets fire to the sodium. And now, the the behavioristic theory is that the pronunciation of a word produces a reaction, just as when you put two elements together or two chemicals together, they produce a reaction. The causal conception of meaning in reductive behaviorism equates both the meaning of the thing and the meaning of the word with our way of reacting. All meaning is sufficiently accounted for by causal relations. The taste of a caterpillar or the sound of a bell are, to be sure, caused by the stimuli. But unless the notion of understanding or interpretation of sign as sign being left out of the notion of meaning, the plausibility of behaviorism vanishes. When we come to linguistic meaning, it is precisely understanding that is the sine qua non of such meaning. The sound does not become a linguistic fact at all until it is detached from its purely causal context. And this detachment and mobility are not functions of the physical environment. If you think that quotation is a little meager, get Irvin's book and read pages 129 to 131. And then Irvin strengthens his attack on behaviorism by a discussion of intention. All this may be and is a valuable refutation of behaviorism. But Irvin's view that words represent rather than are symbols for things has its own difficulties. If you want to work out a theory of language, you will have to choose between saying words represent things or words are symbols of things. They're two different theories. Previously mentioned was Buzz and Uatu. Irvin will not have words to be arbitrary symbols. The symbol is imitative and conjures up the picture of the thing itself. Well, you know what I say about pictures of things. Some of you have pictures. Therefore, picturesque language is more adequate than conceptual language. For example, theory is gray, but life is green. That's a quotation from the famous German romanticist, Goethe. Theory is gray, but life is green would be less adequately expressed in conceptual terms. That is Urban's position. Quite the contrary, so it seems to me. Such metaphors have to be puzzled out and put in literal language before their vagueness is dissipated. They make for good poetry, but not for good understanding. Oh, you can hardly understand poetry. Let me see if I can quote some. There was a poet by the name of Keats. He was a miserable, stupid ass. He said, oh dear, it'll come to me sometime. No, that's literal statement. Yeah. I had it on my tongue just a minute ago. I am so forgetful. You know, truth is beauty and beauty is truth. That is all we know and all we need to know. Now, isn't that stupid? Yeah. Don't read Keats. Even though I disagree with Irvin, read Irvin. I disagree with him, but he even in defending Keats, he makes more sense than Keats does. Of course, there is good poetry, Men of Archivi, child of scorn, cursed the day when he was born. That's good, you know. Who wrote that? Well, why did you laugh so funnily? Does anybody know where it comes from? I think he was an American poet, was he? And he longed for the medieval grace of iron clothing. That's in Men of Archivi. Edwin Arlington Robinson. Yeah. Oh, there are some. Another good poet, his name is Guy Wetmore Carroll. He wrote a volume called Fables for the Frivolous. They're superb. But Keats, no, Keats. Poetry is not good for the understanding. When he says of analogical predication, quote, I am bringing to light some aspect which could not be determined or expressed except by such a transfer, he robs analogy of all meaning. Unless the analogy is based on a literal and univocal similarity, there could be no analogy at all. And I use this argument to pay my respects to Thomas Aquinas and Cornelius Van Til. Urban, indeed, on this very page, states clearly enough the views of those who oppose him. We abuse words when we use them metaphorically, a case of equivocal predication. Analogical predication is ambiguous. He states very clearly the views he opposes. But if some people agree with Urban, others think the view he states so well and rejects so sharply is the literal, non-equivocal truth. Similarly unacceptable is his dictum that all words have originally, unquestionably, a physical reference, and words for relations are primarily spatial in character. That's on page 185, and you'd better read the sentence two or three times again. All words have originally, unquestionably, a physical reference, and words for relations are primarily spatial in character. The term originally may push the question so far back into primitive society that no one can produce evidence for or against the thesis. But if God gave Adam language for the purpose of worship, at least the word God did not have a physical reference. Nor is it evident how the relationship of more wise or more witty could ever have been primarily spatial. Or for that matter, what spatial relationship can be found in uncle or cousin? It would seem that sometimes Urban makes very general assertions without sufficient justification. Urban returns to these points many pages later. All words, he says, have a physical origin and a physical reference. After using such words, someone intuits a value and by metaphor applies the physical word to a new reference. We do not first, this is what Urban says, we do not first intuit an object and then express it. The expression is a constitutive part of the knowing. The language creates the world of cognitive meanings. This paragraph on page 345 is mainly concerned with values, words such as generosity, nobility of character, and moral values in general. Even the word morality, though he does not use this word as one of the examples, even the word morality must have had a physical origin, which then creates a cognitive meaning. This sounds implausible and indeed self-contradictory. It is implausible because without the intuition of an object, there would be no stimulus to expression. Why or how could anyone invent a word, other than a nonsense syllable, if he had nothing to express? The cognitive meaning must come first, and its symbol second. As the science of electricity was being formulated in early modern times, the experimenters noticed certain relationships. To that date, no names had been given them. They had not been known before, so that there was nothing to give names to. But when the intuitions occurred, the scientists took the names of three of their own number, Volta, Ampere, and Ohm, and assigned these names to the level of energy, the quantity of current, and the resistance. Only after a person has a thought can he give it a name. Not only is Urban's theory thus implausible, but is also self-contradictory, because he cannot avoid the difficulty that made it implausible. He had said, "All words are physical in origin. It is through metaphysical transfer that they acquire their new references. They become the vehicle of the intuition and description or expression of new entities." End of quote. Here we have the intuition or knowledge first and the word comes second. But a page and a half later, Urban says, "Any intuition of reality without an element of description is pure myth. Knowing, in any significant sense of the word, is inseparable from language. Language creates," and it was he who italicized this word, that's not my italicizing, "knowing in any language creates the world of cognitive meanings. Intuition is impossible without expression. The expression is rather a constitutive part of the intuition itself. One does not first possess an object in knowing and then express the nature of that object in terms of arbitrary and conventional signs, but the expression is a constituent part of the knowing itself." Aside now from the fact, or if you wish, the appearance of contradiction between pages 145 and 147, aside from that fact, the latter, that is page 147, seems false. Urban uses Croce and aesthetics for support. "The artist does not first intuit or present his object to himself and then find linguistic or other forms with which to express it." End of quote. The present writer deems this to be false because one of his hobbies is oil painting. And he always selects his objects first and then tries to find a form by which to express it. But no doubt Urban would reply, "That is why you're not much of an artist." However, the present writer also writes, and if he does not have the object, the knowledge, the argument, before he puts it in words, any words he should write would be much worse than those now found in these publications. And if Urban had not thought before he wrote, I could not imagine how he could have completed so interesting a book. Without doubt, Urban is indeed interesting, and a great deal of what he says is excellent. He tries to alleviate his notion of spatial reference and pictorial representation by saying that poetry conveys a meaning not expressible in any logical picture. Poetry is pictorial, but not spatial. Now, that wouldn't be true of Baudelaire, would it? Baudelaire's poetry isn't pictorial, is it? Baudelaire's poetry stinks. Yes, he deals with smells. A map is a spatial picture, but Turner's painting of Venice is not spatial. Now, it would seem that a spatial or pictorial theory needs considerable alleviation. But Turner's painting and all other landscapes as well are surely spatial. They may alter the actual proportions of buildings or trees. They may disturb perspective, but surely they are spatial representations. What is better in Urban is his acknowledgement that symbolic representations, chemical formulas, and musical scores are not pictorial. Quite so. But then why extend the term pictorial so far, rather than simply abandoning it as a theory of spatial language? More acceptable, indeed highly commendable, are some of his remarks in refutation of nominalism. Scholastic nominalism, he asserts, is inconsistent because it still retained the reality of individuals. Neo-nominalism abolishes all substantives. All is flux, and names distort reality. If universals are unreal, individuals are unreal too. For the mere naming of a thing is a minimal universal. Neo-nominalism, therefore, has no things, but only events. But this makes nonsense of first, perceptual meanings, second, value meanings, third, descriptions, then fourth, because it makes nonsense of metaphysics, it makes nonsense of all empirical meaning, for the former conditions the latter. We're getting along pretty well. We've got up to page 369. Don't you think you'd finish the book before dinner tonight? Further, that is, unless you want to read Edwin Arlington Robinson. Further, in opposition to his opponents, Urban remarks that it is an assumption of evolutionary naturalism, not a necessity of logic, that language is purely practical. Even if it had originally been such, it may have developed other uses since. But even at first, language was not purely practical. It was made for human communication, and this is wider than mere practicality. The difficulties in Urban's extensive material seems to spring from the opposition between his basic empiricism and its unwanted implications. Meaning and verifiability are inseparable, he says. But observation is not the sole method of verification. Mere sense data are not knowledge. No sentence is purely ostensive. Oh dear, read something about ostensive definitions. I hope you've heard of them before, but maybe you haven't. St. Augustine has a long section on ostensive definitions. And Bertrand Russell, of course, Augustine is opposed to ostensive definitions. Bertrand Russell favors ostensive definitions. He makes them basic, and that is one of the main flaws in his theory. Direct verification is a myth. It is one sentence that verifies another sentence. Sentences are needed to interpret the sense datum. For example, an observation of Mercury as verification involves a host of presuppositions. I'm referring to Einstein, of course. The isolated observations cannot verify. Therefore, also, perceptual truth is only probable. Sometimes Urban is not only perceptive, but witty as well. The several theories of truth, he says, correspondence, coherence, and pragmatic, cannot be sustained by their own criteria. Correspondence cannot be shown to correspond to truth. Coherence coheres with nothing. And the pragmatic theory does not work. Therefore, the neo-positivists conclude that the meaning of truth is a meaningless question. For if meaning is always reference to a sensory object, truth can have no meaning, because it refers to no object. The truth of the criteria is truth only of interpretation. Along with wit and insight, Urban's constructive theory contains much that is puzzling. It seems that originally language with its onomatopoeic words was always poetry, or at least aesthetic expression. Science came later. Even though he so extends the term poetry to include prose as well, its language is neither cognitive nor practical. Its power is the power to evoke images. The intellectualist fallacy views the aesthetic symbol as an imperfect substitute for philosophic or scientific knowledge. On the contrary, Urban asserts, the symbol contains an unexpressed reference which the abstract concept cannot express. The question is, but is this so? Keats' Ode to a Grecian Urn, though its abstract concepts in the last two lines are utter nonsense, expresses something about a moment detached from the flux of time. It does not express it very well, and we can hardly be sure what Keats had in mind. Probably he was somewhat confused. But had he thought clearly and expressed himself intelligibly, a reader, no matter how poetical the poem, could have put the meaning into clear conceptual prose. What cannot be expressed clearly is not meaningful. The same is true of all art. Take the painting Angelus. In our civilization, the attitude of the two persons is recognized as the attitude of prayer. Presumably, because they are French peasants, the painting pictures Roman Catholic devotion. But the painting does not convey this information. Present such pictures to people who know nothing about France or Roman Catholicism, for example, a Tibetan monk or a Japanese shogun of last century, and they can only ask, what does it mean? I had a very pointed example of this. There was a group of Japanese professors who were visiting universities in this country on a tour, and the whole group came to Indianapolis and stayed in the homes of various professors, and we had a gentleman from Kyoto. He was professor of Irish poetry in the University of Kyoto, Japan. A very nice gentleman. Well, we were going through the theater there on the campus, and in the lobby there is a tapestry. It is probably about 20 feet by 20 feet. It's a rather gigantic affair. And there's a boat and a lake and some fishermen are pulling in some fish, and the man that happened to be with me at the moment looked at it, and he says, what is the story? Well, I told him the case of the miraculous draught of fishes. This was Christ who told the disciples to put their net down on the other side of the boat and bring in a whole net full of fish. Well, you see, he couldn't get that from the painting. And if you think you can get any Christian message from a painting, you're mistaken. You are imposing the message on it because you know the background already. Take a person who does not have a Christian background. They won't see anything particularly Christian in the Angelus or in the miraculous draught of fishes, anything else. Painting can express a few things, but not too much. Now that requires a theory of art, doesn't it? Well, I'm all in favor of a theory of art, too. Now, the painting does not convey the information. A Tibetan monk wouldn't understand it. The abstract or conceptual statement is far clearer than any picture can be. One of Urban's examples is Pascal's phrase, man is a reed, but a thinking reed. The context there in Pascal is that a man is a rather fragile creature. He says the least thing can kill him. A drop of water can kill him if it gets in the wrong place. And he's subject to other things. So he says, man is a reed in nature, but a thinking reed. Urban continues, to say that man is a reed is biologically grotesque. Yet it is by precisely such deviations from the real that certain aspects of reality, otherwise inexpressible, are actually expressed. Now, Pascal, the mathematical genius, could, when he wished, use metaphorical and poetic language. But to say that his meaning is otherwise inexpressible is not biologically but intellectually grotesque. One can say man's bones are more easily cracked than granite, and a drop of water properly placed can kill him, yet neither the rock nor the water can think, and thinking is infinitely superior to mere physical existence. The aesthetic quality is here missing, but the thought is nonetheless more intelligibly expressed. And the thought is superior to the mere aesthetic enjoyment. Urban also quotes four lines from T.S. Eliot as expressive or revelatory to an extraordinary degree. The first two lines of Eliot's poetry are intelligible. The third may be guessed at, but the fourth expresses or reveals nothing but the unintelligible confusion of T.S. Eliot's mind. Repeating the idea, not otherwise expressible, four pages later, and after another 10 pages of fairly clear expression of his ideas, Urban defends himself by saying, in that symbolic form, an aspect of reality is given which cannot be adequately expressed otherwise. It is not true that whatever is expressed symbolically can be better expressed literally. For there is, and the quote, the italics is Urban's, for there is no literal expression, but only another kind of symbol. To which the intellectualist replies, the cat is black. Anyone who then says the cat is black is a poetical metaphor does not deserve a literal denial. For the purpose at hand, this monograph cites Urban as a defender of religious language against the positivist assertion that religion is meaningless. The reader may now anticipate how he does so. Religion and poetry are closely related but not identical. The emotion of religion has the quality of the holy, which poetry does not necessarily have. Religious language is not only evocative but invocative as well. Thus, religion has a personal God and is therefore dramatic and mythic. As the poet gets something of reality which the scientist has missed, so the religious person gets something the poet has missed. Religious language communicates something other language cannot. These several of Urban's phrases are at best ambiguous. Of course the poet gets something the physicist, qua physicist, has missed. Does not biological language grasp something chemistry has missed? The language of football gets and misses what the language of international diplomacy misses and gets. The confusion here is between language as such and the various subject matters of conversation. Of course, chemistry is not botany. But language, for the language of all of these is the same, the English language. Urban's statement, therefore, is true and trivial. What he really means, as his own wording in one place indicates, is that religion is emotional. Religion has no place for thinking. It is not intelligible. God can't be known. Belief has no place. This is surely not trivial. It's simply false. If it is not false, then Christianity is not a religion. The religions Urban can identify all speak the same language, he says, and are immediately friends. Well, he's not the only person that said that. That, well, you know, that was in the first chapter of the 3R book, wasn't it? It was the fellow who shot our missionary enterprise to pieces. You know, what's his name now? Hocking, yes. See, I don't have the word, but I have the thought all right. If I didn't have the thought, I wouldn't know that one word was the right word. The religions Urban can identify all speak the same language and are immediately friends. But Christ had religious enemies. He said, "No man cometh to the Father but by me." Christ, of course, was not very religious. Well, maybe Jesus was religious once in a while, for Holy Communion is a simple piece of symbolism to express a number of spiritual truths too great for ordinary language. The symbol expresses something too great for words. Page 586. Now, the present writer, whose theology is known to a certain public, may not and does not claim to understand all the logical implications of the Lord's Supper. But unless he had a literal understanding of some of its intellectual meaning, he would have no reason for going through the motions. In opposition to sacramentarianism, where the magic works apart from the understanding, the scripture says, "Let a man examine himself," an intellectual task. "For he that eateth and drinketh unworthily, eateth and drinketh damnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body," an intellectual task. Therefore, the Covenanters and the Calvinists will not celebrate the supper without a sermon to be understood. As Calvin said, an implicit faith is no faith at all. More broadly, if Adam and Eve, on page 590, are merely mythological or metaphorical expressions of man's emotional alienation from an unknowable God, then Jesus is simply a character in Aesop's fables to represent a fanciful union with that God. This implication by itself does not refute Urban's religion, but it shows that it is not the Christian religion. The implication also suggests, in fact, Urban's religious theory demands, that his religion be irrational. And that, to me, of course, is repulsive. Though he himself had said that God is personal, this statement also must be mythological and has no intelligible meaning. Its concrete terms are not what religion really says. Quoting Brightman with approval, Urban's idea of God symbolizes, and again, this is Urban's italicizing, not mine, the idea of God symbolizes a unity or harmony between existence and value. But no doubt this impersonal harmony is itself also a literally untrue myth. Urban indeed tries to salvage religious language from the nonsense of logical positivism, but he so empties it of all intelligible meaning that the result is no better.